Well, hello runners. Welcome to the I Run Things podcast, the podcast for the everyday runner in search for that extra bit of motivation to get out there. My name's Susie, and I am your host. Today, I bring you the Marathon Whisperer. Denise is a coach, and she has run a whopping 118 marathons. She's also the author of the book, Me, You, and 26.2. And she's given away one of her books, signed and dedicated to one of the listeners of this podcast. To be able to get a copy of the book, you need to send me a message on Instagram to @realirunthings, and the links will be in the show notes below, answering the following question. What was the song that they all sang to celebrate they finished the Everest Marathon? Again, what was the song that the whole group of runners sang to celebrate that they finished the Everest Marathon? And now, this is a pretty long episode. The adventures, it's just amazing what she had to go through to accomplish this. And I'm just gonna let her tell us her story. Without further ado, here is Denise and the Everest Marathon. Hi, Denise. How are you?
I'm good. How are you, Susie?
I'm great. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
This is probably, like, usually I talk and I greet guests before we start recording, and that conversation goes for a few minutes. But just so everybody knows, we've been talking for, actually, this is not showing me, but we've been talking for probably a good 25 minutes.
Like so, 40 minutes.
Really?
40 minutes, yeah.
Oh my God. You're awesome. You're absolutely awesome. So yeah, I'm super excited about having you, and you're going to be my first guest who's going to be on two different episodes. You're going to talk first about the Everest Marathon, and then you're going to come back and talk about Comrades Marathon, which you actually did twice.
Yes.
Which is just amazing in and of itself. So yeah, tell us who you are.
Sure. So I'm Denise. I'm also known as the Marathon Whisperer. I live in Chicago, and you know, after I did my first marathon in 1994, it changed me on the inside. And through all these decades, I just did my 118th marathon, but through all these decades of running, I really realized that what it did is it turned the I can't into what else can I do. And, you know, fast forward, I did my first one. During it, I said, never again. This hurts so bad, like uppercase bold fonts. And, you know, the pain goes away. And then we're like, oh, that wasn't so bad. Now I got to get faster. And so I found a coach, got really fast. And then I just, you know, I've been running. I actually been running since the fourth grade, because I still don't have eye hand ball coordination. And the great thing about running is it welcomes everyone, every pace, every size, every age. And so it's been my best friend since fourth grade. But what happened after I found a coach, he got me crazy fast. Like, I had no idea what I had in me. And that's why I tell my runners, I'm now a coach for 10 years, but I tell my runners, like, you don't know what else you have in you when, you know, because most coaches, I feel like they work with people that are already, like, gifted, you know? So how much more can you improve them on? But we never know, like, what someone has in them when they, you know, when they're, you start adding speed workouts and they don't run through when an injury, but smarter training and then bring up the intensity. So I gratefully, you know, I got really fast. And then like every time I raced, if I didn't get a PR, I'd beat myself up. And then if I did get a PR, I would be proud, but oof, then it would fleet. So I really lost sight of what the fourth grade girl found in running, like how it, you know, I always feel better during and after. It's been my mode of transportation for seeing the world. I mean, not fourth grade, but since, it's brought so many friends into my life that I would have missed out on. Like, if we didn't have the commonality of running, who knows when we would have met, Susie, right? And so gratefully, August 16, 2009, I was heading to Central Park to get a PR in the New York City half. I was running 60 to 70 miles a week. I never did junk miles, hard. And gratefully, I got hit by a car and I flew on the hood and shattered the windshield with my body, bounced off the hood, landed in front of the car. But gratefully, I survived. Like I only had to wear a back brace. I broke 5 vertebrae where the muscles attached, not near the spinal column. So there were just so many thank God moments. And once I was mentally and physically stable, I just felt like there was a reason why I survived. And I just knew in my heart, like, I just wanted to get back to running for what it had given to me, like some of the things I mentioned. And so I started coaching. And I just love it. Like, it just, if you've ever seen the movie E.T., like, my heart lights up when I get, like, when either I, like, inspire someone and guide them to see they can do a marathon or they can do a half, or when I get unsolicited texts and emails from my athletes that I, you know, help them find the joy in running again or help them run their fastest mile, whatever. My heart lights up like E.T. So I started coaching a year after the accident, and then going back to that first marathon, Chicago 1994, and how it turned the I can't into what else can I do. I feel like what it does for us as humans is it ignites like this little empowerment engine within us that's been waiting to be lit, right? And so every time you do something you don't think you can do, I call it you're skited. Like something you want to do, but you don't know if you're going to succeed. I call it scared and excited, skited. And so the more things you do like that, you're making like a deposit. And so what happened was I ended up doing a couple Ironmans, and I'm deathly afraid of open water, deathly. Like I even quit an Ironman swim. And I've jumped out of a plane and jumped off a bungee ramp, platform, whatever, deathly afraid of heights. I used to be really bad at public speaking. So I took improv classes. So it gives you courage to see, like, let me find out what else is possible. And that's just part of you're shortchanging yourself when you don't do that. Like, it's part of our own unique human experience. So fast forward 2016, I've been coaching a while, and I'm just so fulfilled by helping people do something they didn't think they could do. And I decorporated. I left my 26 year career in accounting to coach full time. And I love it. I love it. It's like, I'm so fulfilled. I have a different definition of success. Like, it's not a promotion. It's not like what my title is. It really is those unsolicited texts and emails and seeing people transform from, you know, self-doubt to I did it. Now what else can I do? Or even also when they inspire people in their circle, I call it whispering. Right. Yeah. So that's kind of how I ended up coaching. But I did my first like international race, and I think it was like 2000 or 2001. I did the Berlin Marathon. That was the first time that like planted the seed for these racecations. And out of my 118 marathons, I've run on all 7 continents. I've done the Abbott World Marathon Majors. I've gotten 2 of those 6 stars. So I have the Abbott Dozen. My dream marathon, 2 of them, I'm looking for sponsors to help out. But I want to do the North Pole Marathon. And then I want to do the 7 marathons in 7 days and 7 continents. Those are like my 2 bucket lists. But so what brought us together outside of our favorite topic running is Everest. So I did the Everest Marathon May 2019, and it's tied. Like people ask me what's my favorite marathon, and honestly it's that first, because it I have chills. Like it transformed me on the inside, and it just, it opened up so much in my life that I would have missed out on. But after that, like my top two, like my favorite marathons outside of our first, my first was the Antarctica Marathon and the Everest Marathon. Like they're both tied. And then it's Patagonia, Chile, and Queenstown, New Zealand. But let's get back to Everest.
Why did you choose to do Everest?
So I'm so in awe, and so like I've read so many books on Everest, and I've reread them. I've watched so, there's just, I don't know the one thing that has hooked my heart on it. But again, I cannot watch enough documentaries on it and rewatch. And, but I'm afraid of heights, right? And this is how afraid of heights I am, in that, you know, even if I'm reading about somebody going over a crevasse on a ladder, I am afraid for their life. Even though I'm reading about it, or if I'm watching the documentary or seeing it on the news. Like there was a guy in our group who did the Everest Marathon. They divide you up into maybe like 15 people, and then you have a doctor. We'll get to that. But there was a guy named Rob in our group who, he's definitely afraid of heights. There were two guys afraid of heights, and they've done all seven summits. But he was telling us how he forgot to clamp in when they, I don't know what part in the mountain they were on. But he was like hanging and swinging from the mountain, and like, and I was afraid. He's like, Denise, I made it. I'm here. But that's how afraid of heights I am. So I just always knew, like, Everest Base Camp is as far as I can go. Cause I'm afraid of heights. And I was even afraid of the suspension bridges. And then somebody told me, again, seeing somebody walk across this, I was afraid for them. But someone said, Denise, the yaks go over them. So they're strong enough for that. So I was like, oh, I was fine. So, it's always been a dream of mine to go there. And then one of my friends, Michelle, she said, did you know there's a marathon at Everest? And I was like, oh my gosh, finally someone, because not many people are interested in Everest. And so as soon as she said that, I'm like, I am in, let's do it. And it was just, you know, when you do these destination races, it isn't about the race. It's about, you know, what everything else you're going to see. Yeah. And especially with Everest. So we hiked to what happens. So the Everest Marathon, it's always run on May 29th, because that's the anniversary of when it was successfully summited by Tenzing Norgay and Sir Edmund Hillary. And so what happens is we end up hiking for 10 days from Namche Bazaar to base camp. And so base camp to Namche is a marathon. And I felt like everyone's like, I'm from Chicago, flatlands, no altitude. And everyone was like, how did you do that? And I just felt like they warned us ahead of time, or advised us ahead of time, to go out, get altitude sickness pills and hydrate. And so I did that. And I felt like the tour company that we went with, it was a really conservative climb. Like, I think the most we ever hiked, like we would hike 4 hours to 6 hours every day. And then sometimes we would just stay in a village. So I felt like it was smart and conservative, the hike. And that is
so what, how do you get, so you have to climb before you even get to the start line of the marathon?
Oh yeah. You're hiking up. And so okay. The route we're taking is the route we're going to take down for the marathon.
Oh, so the marathon is going down.
Yes. It goes. So okay. The 10 days is Namche Bazaar up to, I think it's earlier than that. Cause we, Lukla, it's actually Lukla. We're hiking from Lukla all the way to base camp, and okay. Then base camp to Namche is the marathon. And there's also an ultra marathon too. And so, there, like the first time I saw Everest, I got so emotional, and there were points on the hike where I literally just started crying from the magnitude of the beauty. And I think also that like I've read about everyone else's journey to Everest. I know I didn't summit, but going to base camp, like that, I finally, like on my drive home from the airport, I called each of my parents. They're not married, that's why I called them separate. But I was like, you know, in my lifetime, I've lived out two dreams. You know, how many of us like actually, you know, follow through on that? I left my career to coach full time and I got to go to Everest Base Camp. Like, and just again, so the magnitude of the beauty is what drew me, what is having me go back. I'm going back next year. I already gave my deposit. I'm going back next year to do the ultra. And wow. A lot of the people that were in my group, like they, oh, I'm not coming back. There's other places to see. And I knew my heart, like, I cannot wait to come back. But I do have to tell you, so I actually, I did a lot of videos and I posted on social. So the thing is, you are limited with how much gear you can bring. Like the tour company tells you, this is all the recommended gear. And you have to make it only weigh X. I don't remember what it was, but it was the worst math problem. I was so stressed because we can only have so much on our bag when we fly into Lukla, that airport where if you miss the runway, you go into the mountain. That I was
so much fun.
Well, that was like, I was afraid of the suspension bridges. And then someone called me. They're like, the yaks go on them. And I was freaked out about that airport. And then this guy I met at a training center here in Chicago, he had attempted to summit. I don't remember how high he made it, but he said those pilots, they train for 15 or 20 years for that route. So again, I was like, okay, I can handle that. But yeah, so that was a really hard component, is figuring out like, here's your packing list, but you got to make it all way only X. And that was really hard. And so then on the hike, we had a day pack on us, and then the porters would take our duffel. And so each day, like all you're doing is hiking and you're shut off from the world, right? And it's just, you're in Mother Nature's, it was just so beautiful. So our goal every day was to get to the next tea house. And plus you're surrounded by other people with the same passion, and it's like the other people that have the same like curiosity on the inside. Like, I don't wanna just read about Everest, I wanna go there. So the people you met, and then the locals, oh my goodness. And you would see people, you would see the porters, like they're wearing Crocs or they're wearing flip-flops. And here I am in these heavy duty boots, hiking poles, and they have like no support shoes, no poles. And one guy was carrying a stove down from base camp on his back. Like the locals there, the Sherpas and the porters, they are like, I would love to sponsor one and have them come and run the Chicago Marathon, because they already have the strength and then their altitude training. But they are, yeah. And then here I, you know, we're all in this nice gear and they're nothing. Like, yeah.
How many people are with you in the group? Like how many people are running the marathon?
So there's a half marathon and a marathon and an ultra. There may have been a 10K. No, that was Patagonia. So I think there were maybe like 200 people in total.
Oh, wow. And how many porters?
Some are local too. And so they divide us into a group of 15. And we probably had at least 8 porters and one Sherpa. And then like I don't know the title, but someone right under a Sherpa. And then a doctor. Once we left Lukla, we had a doctor with us. And then when we left Kathmandu, we had an English-speaking guide with us the whole way.
So they divide you in groups of 15?
And that's who we hike. That's who we hike with. And some people got to the tea house. My friend Michelle and I, both from Chicago, we were in the back. But I was in no hurry because it was so beautiful. And I kept thinking, I wonder if people that live in the mountains would be so in awe of this, or it's just because I'm in like the land of high rises.
Well, I would guess they get used to it, but Is there anything like, is there's no trees or no wildlife?
Oh yeah, I mean, it's beautiful. The scenery is beautiful. I mean, I took so many pictures. The one thing though that, you know, I was, when we got to the tea house, we would have Wi-Fi. You'd have to pay for it. And that's when I would post pictures or videos. And so, you know, the further up you get up the mountain, the more it's going to weed out people who cannot like go to the bathroom in a bucket. No lie. The bathrooms got worse the further up. Right. And it really was only cold at night because the tea houses didn't have any heat. And so you literally, I made this video of a Everest marathon hat. And, you know, the bad thing about taking the altitude sickness pills is that you have to go to the bathroom all the time. Plus you're drinking more water than normal. So I probably had to go to the bathroom 3 times in the middle of the night. So I would sleep with my headlamp around my neck. So I did a video like, so you don't have to dig for it. You just turn your light on. Yeah. And I did a video of like what the bathrooms were like, because I was like, I'm showing all this beauty. And I said, okay, this is going to weed the weak people out. You got to be able to handle this. And I had my girlfriend demonstrate, because it literally was like a hole at one of the tea house or in one of the villages. It was just a hole in the ground. And I'm like, well, this is a hovering toilet and we'll be lucky to get like a squatting toilet. Or no, that was a hover and a whatever. But then the cool thing about doing, one of the many cool things about doing the Everest Marathon is that usually when people go up to Everest Base Camp, unless they're summiting, they have to hike right back down. And so because we were affiliated with the race, we got to camp at Base Camp for 2 nights. How freaking cool is that, right? But the thing, so going back to how cold it was. So at night it was cold. And what you do is whatever clothes you're going to wear in the morning, you shove them in your sleeping bag and all your electronics. And so at base camp, that was really, it was freezing at night, but you're sleeping next to the ice fall. It was so cool. But I didn't know this. So in the middle of the night, because usually at races, I don't do much homework. Because then you analyze, overanalyze. I mean, I did the packing list. And I didn't even know it was so special that we got to camp at base camp. But because again, I don't read up on this stuff. I'd rather experience it. So the first night at base camp, I woke up at like 2 or 3 in the morning and I thought I heard thunder. And my roommate, my tent mate, she's like snoring, whatever. And I was freaking out. So that was an avalanche. Those are common, Denise.
Oh my God.
At breakfast, I was like, did you guys hear that? It sounded like thunder. They're like, Denise, those are avalanches. And it happened a lot. So yes, I was very freaked out.
I would have never thought they sound similar.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's insane. So is there people at base camp all year round?
No, only in the hiking season. So
okay.
I know like people that go to Summit Base Camp, they usually, they start hiking in March. And then there's a short window when they can actually summit from the, I don't remember the name of the second to last camp they're at before they go to summit. But there's maybe like a week or 10 days, if that, in June where they can summit. So the year that I did it was where they had a lot of unfortunate deaths. Because a lot of people are going there and they don't even know how to put crampons on. And they're just plopping the money down without the experience. So it's really sad. Like people passed away coming down, or people had summited and then they were trying to come down from the Hillary step and they passed away because there was such a backlog. But the thing, so there's also a fall season too for summiting. But you know, it's their biggest source of income. So
right.
I feel like you need to have done the other six summits. I feel like you need to have done the other six summits to be able to do Everest.
Right.
It was really sad. And people are like, are you okay? I'm like, don't you people know I'm afraid of heights? I would never go up to, like, I'm afraid for people going up the Hillary Step or going over crevasses, or even when they're close to summiting, like they talk about how they put their pole in the snow and you can see like Tibet down there. Like, yeah. So
yeah, that requires some, they probably have one of those out of body experiences. That's the way that I picture, so that you're not afraid. You know, yeah. Like, yes, or, it's not like, you know, that you're there, but you have, you're like experiencing it from the outside. Like, it's not really you. See what I mean? Like, you probably are able to
shut the fear off.
Yes. Yeah.
And also, right. like the two guys that had, were afraid of heights and did all seven summits. It's, they, yeah, they trusted their equipment and the people they were with, and you shut the fear off.
Right.
Yeah. Each group of the 15 people, each group had a doctor with them, and they were checking, like, some of the people in our group did not do the altitude sickness pills and they got really sick. So they were watching over them, and they would test their oxygen level with the thingy that you just put your finger in. And then at a certain altitude, they checked all of us, what our oxygen levels were. And then they would check us before the race to see if there was a delta. And then they also like would check to see if, you know, if anyone wasn't looking right. But I felt safe having a doctor with us.
Right. It's good to have one, because
yeah,
sometimes you don't notice how, you know, if you really want to run a race, yeah, you're not going to, yeah, your mind is going to say, I'm feeling better, even if you're not feeling well.
Oh,
yeah.
One of the guys, he looked deathly ill. Like, he looked so bad. Like, he should have been sent down sooner. And he's like, I'm going to do it. And the further up we went, like, the less plush our, where we stay was, but I didn't care because the beauty blew it away. And that's the other thing that was cool about it. It's like, everyone is also raw because everything's taken away. You know, like, we don't really know what people do for it. We all just share this common passion, and we don't know where people live really, what they drive and what they do for a living. And then no makeup, whatever. It's just raw. It was so beautiful. And so we had the 10-day hike, and then we slept at base camp 2 days. And so now the marathon takes place. And you have to get to, I can't remember the name of the village, but it's where, it's like one of the oldest monasteries. And actually on the hike up, we stopped there and we got to hear the monks chanting. It was like, it was the whole trip, I have chills. And so from base camp to this village, it's the 20-mile mark, and you only had, I had 9 hours to get there, 20 miles, right? You think nothing.
Oh, wow.
But it was, so for me, I normally do a marathon in like 4 hours, and the marathon took me 12 hours and 15 minutes. And I was racing, like I was racing. And if anyone knows me, I take pictures throughout the race, and cause I want people to see, what I see so they can come do it too at my race, whenever I do race station. I took 2 pictures at the start and that was it. So I was racing my tail off. I made it in 9.5 hours and it was already dark, and I got lost a couple times. I probably got lost 3 times because you have 200 people across the Himalayas. And I think the people that laid the flags out, some of the flags were, it was windy, so some of the flags weren't there. So I got lost. So and even like 2 days before I had a game day decision, one of the other guys in our group, I think it was his second marathon, some people it was their first, he said he was going to use his hiking boots. And so we knew what the terrain was going up, and it was very technical. There was hardly anything that was runnable. I mean, unless you live in Colorado, if you live in the mountains, but for me, it was not runnable. So I actually did a marathon in my hiking boots, and I used my hiking poles because, instead of save the whales, it was save the ankles. So I made it down to the village where the monastery is in 9.5 hours, and they're like, you can go ahead. And I was mentally and physically spent. Like, and I knew what that last 10K was gonna be. It was great. It took me, the next day I restarted with a bunch of other folks, and it took me over 3 hours to do a 10K. Like, that's how technical the terrain was. Yeah.
Wow, that's insane. So the person that arrived, the first person, how long did it take that person to finish?
Oh my goodness, I have to look that up, but I know it was a bunch of locals.
Okay, so they're used to.
Yeah.
They're used to the distance and the incline and the, was it like, could you have like food on your person or something that you could eat or drink?
Oh yeah, so on our hike up, we had a day pack, and that's where you needed like, that's where I carried like waterproof wind pants, and I had a down jacket and food, and we would get, we had bottles or bladders and bottles that at the tea house they would put, steam the water so then it was clean. So we had water on us, and yeah. So during the marathon though, I didn't have a day pack. I just had like a vest. I just had, I can't remember the name, but I had
a camelback.
Almost like a camelback, but I had pockets in the front. So when I got to that village, I was freezing because I'm in sweaty clothes. It's probably like 6 at night. And luckily the photographer from our group was there, and he gave me a fleece jacket he had in his backpack. So I stayed at a tea house, and yeah, so that's where, like, I'm going back next year. I already gave my deposit, and I'm gonna shoot for the ultra. Yeah, the girl that took 12 hours and 15 minutes to do a marathon. But I think what would have made a difference is, you know, doing trails. I didn't run any trails. I did like 2 trail runs, a race and then a run. And, you know, maybe going out to Colorado to do altitude training. Like, that would have helped me improve my time. But since I didn't, that's why I did it in 12 hours and 15 minutes. But one of the gifts of that experience was that now I know how my runners feel, that like my folks that do Tokyo, and they only get 7 hours from when the first person crossed the start line, or my folks that do Boston, and it's 6 hours from when the last person. So now I know what it's like to travel to a race and to be under the gun to hit a time. So that was a huge gift from that experience.
Did you? So what happens if something happens to you when you're running down?
Yeah, so there were some checkpoints for the runners. And then like if something happened, there were sweepers in the back. And then like either you let someone know at an aid station or when you see a local.
But do you have, I don't know, I picture like when you said you got lost a couple of times, what if you get lost and you like really get disoriented, like you can't find?
It was scary. And that's where I, so with the ultra marathon, every ultra athlete gets a local who is with them, and the marathoners in the half are just following the flats. And so after the race, I emailed the tour company and I'm like, I will pay extra to have a private guide, like, you know, because I feel like too, you know, like if you give someone directions for your running route, there's things you take for granted, right? Because you've done it over and over. So right. I feel like partly it was windy, the flags blew away. And then the other thing is we don't, you know, they may not have flagged it as if they don't, it wasn't their first time there. They don't remember their first time there. Yeah. And you know, we hiked all the way up, but I don't have a visual memory to remember.
I think it's different for a first timer because you're going up and you're paying attention to other things. Totally. Like when I'm hiking, for example, I was hiking maybe 3 or 4 weeks ago with a friend. It was like really I shouldn't say a hike. It was more like going through a park, but you know, it was a hike, quote unquote.
Yeah.
So they, you know how they paint the, you know, like this is the red.
Yeah.
Trail, this is the green trail. We had a map. We got lost, I want to say 3 or 4 times, and it was on a flat course, like through marshlands. It's like, how are we doing this? Like, yeah. I don't understand. So to me, that I could see myself getting lost like easily. If they put flags, I could see myself missing something because I never understand where to look for them.
Yeah.
Like when you're hiking, it's the same way. Like sometimes they paint a red thing on a tree and I'm looking the other way.
Or
I'm
not have looking a post.
Yeah. Yeah. So
I do think part of it, like my friend Michelle, she was behind me and she got lost too. She got lost. She went like 2 miles out of her way. And and I think part of it is like I should have done more trail. But there were people behind me and there were other people that spent the night in that little village. So I feel like personally I could have trained smarter. Yeah.
So when you are getting ready for Everest, what kind of recommendation does a tour company give you? Like in terms of like, do they tell you how to train or?
No, they didn't
give us. What to anticipate or anything like that?
No, they gave us like a packing list and then they recommended there's certain shots that you have to get and then what day you absolutely have to be in Kathmandu. And then they recommended the altitude sickness pills and hydrate, but they didn't recommend, they don't offer training.
Right. You know? But they don't say, I don't know, they could say, we recommend that you participate in a scavenger. You know how there's phrases that are scavenger? I don't know, yeah. Something that,
or that you,
yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think even like if we can get the, what is it, a GPX?
Right.
With the GPX of the course and upload it to our watches, like that would have helped.
Right. Or, you know, there's trail races that are very, you know, adventure trail races, like in Europe, that you have to have those mini satellite phones.
Yeah.
So that, because if you get lost, at least you can call someone and, you know,
yeah, kind of like that.
Airlift you. Yeah.
That documentary series, Alone. Have you ever seen
yeah.
that?
Yeah. 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 I mean, it's just, I don't know. To me, it's just that you could get lost for like 2 hours and just wander around in the middle of the Everest. You know,
like, yeah. I mean, how I took a map with me, the course map with me. So when I did see a local, I would just point at the direction I needed to go. And but it was few and far between when I did see a local. And I was going to say, I was scared because I'm lost in the Himalayas and I don't know where I'm going.
So what are they? So when you encounter a local, what are the locals doing? Like, where are they going?
They're going up and down from base camp. Yeah.
Oh, so they're maybe taking stuff.
Yeah, yeah. So with that short window of when folks can actually summit, by the time we got to base camp, almost everyone was down that had summited. They were already on their way down. And that's when the path to get up there, the trail to get up there was really crowded because people were coming down. And that's when I saw like porters were carrying like huge, like buffet tables on their back. Yeah, it was crazy, but.
Do they speak English, the porters and the Sherpas?
A lot of them do.
Okay.
Even if it's only a little bit, yeah.
That's interesting. And do you get a sense that's what they do for a living, the whole, like, because there's only a season. So do they leave off of that the rest of the year?
Right. So what I heard from our group is like the Sherpa handpicks the porters, and it's an honor because, you know, it's there's only 2 seasons, and it's like one of the few ways to make money. So it really is an honor to be part of a trekking crew because the jobs are so limited there. That's why it's so sad that they didn't have a season. Because of COVID, like that's one of the very few ways they make money. And is it Nepal is like one of the poorest countries, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
So even though I got lost and I had bathrooms that were a hole in the ground, and at base camp, there were avalanches and our bathroom was literally a bucket with a plastic bag in it. I knew I was going back, and a lot of the people I was with, they're like, no, there's other places I want to see, and I would do a different part of the Himalaya. And as, you know, weeks went by, month, they're all like, I can't wait to go back.
Right. Because it's an experience that is so out of the ordinary.
Yeah. Plus it's like, you're really like, you're in your thoughts. Like I could not, I had so much reflection time on those hikes, and because everything's stripped away. I mean, granted I was posting to social media at night, but for the majority of the day, I'm in my own thoughts and such amazing beauty. But yeah.
Right. So when you were running the actual marathon, was there any moment when you thought you were not going to make it? Like, I am not going to get there, or like, I'm in so much pain. What did you feel? Like,
it was more, I'm not going to make that 9-hour cutoff. And that was my goal. Cause I was like 20 miles in 9 hours. Like I can stop for lots of donuts on the way, you know? And that's why I was just mentally and physically spent when I got to the check-in point, and they're like, you can go ahead. And I was like, no, and it worked out, because the next day, that last 10K was still really hard. Because again, it took me 3 hours to go 6 miles.
So they let you sort of
hard. Like I wasn't taking pictures. I was racing.
Do they let you, like, are you able to like take a nap when you arrive to that checking point before you finish the other 10K? Or are you just able to sit down for a couple hours and then keep going?
Yeah, there was a tea house there, so you could have sat inside, got something to eat, and then restarted. But you had to get to 20 miles by 9, that check-in point, before the 9-hour cutoff.
Right. So do people do that, or do they just say, okay, I'm just going to take a cup of tea and I'm going to keep going, yeah, or so eat something and I keep going?
That's what they would do, because they knew they could make the last 10K.
What happens at the end when you, do they have like, I don't know, what's at the finish line?
Oh, so again, there were like maybe, I think 5 or 6 of us that the next morning started off together with a porter, and they were faster than me. So I was with the porter again, gratefully. And I'm probably like maybe 200 yards from the finish. And I'm gonna start crying, because like 3 of my friends came running up the path to run me in. And I did not, I mean, you're mentally and physically drained. And you know, when you're in a race, when you're in a race and you see someone you know that's near and dear to your heart, like you just get this energy within. And so I mean, the fact that I'm crying now thinking about that, it was totally unexpected. I was mentally and physically spent. So they came up and ran with me, and then I crossed the finish line together or by myself. And then I think I like got on my knees and kissed the ground.
Like, it was, Pope.
that's why we do these things, to challenge ourselves, right?
Right.
Yeah. And you got a medal. And I mean, everyone else had been, almost everyone else, like I'd say 80% finished the day before. But then my friends walked me back to our tea house, and I'd see some of the other people in our group, and they're like, yay, yay. And it was beautiful.
Oh,
yeah.
And then after you do that, do you have to keep walking? Like, are you hiking back somewhere else, or do they pick you up there and then you're good? So, you can go to a hotel and relax.
So we all finished in Namche, right? And so we had 2 days there, except I slept in that tea house by the monastery. So the other folks had 2 nights in Namche and I had 1 night. But some of the folks had enough of Everest, and they got a private helicopter out of Namche.
Gonna say.
So they went Namche to Lukla. They had enough in I mean, there were parts because, oh my goodness. So then we, you know, the next day, we hiked from Namche to Lukla, and I don't even remember how many hours that was, but I didn't realize the end of May is monsoon season. So during the hike, oh my goodness, we're hiking down like the side of a mountain, and there's this crazy like monsoon, no lie. So one thing I learned is I needed a waterproof wrap for my backpack, because they don't really make waterproof backpacks, they make covers. So I gotta do that the next time. But I had no idea, because again, I didn't do my homework, I didn't read. It's monsoon season. That was crazy. And one of the girls in our group, she actually, during the marathon, she slipped, and she's a really strong, fast, she slipped and she broke her arm. So she had to get helicoptered off of the course down to Lukla. So she was one of the girls that ran up to greet me when I was coming in. And so we're hiking from Namche back to Lukla, and she's got her arm strapped and no hiking poles, and she's going down fine. Yeah, but the monsoon, I forgot. That was crazy.
Wow. So what's the temperature? Is there like there must be a difference, like a great difference in between, you know, base camp and Lukla, right? Like in temperature?
Yeah, because base camp was like 17.6, and I think Lukla might be around 9,000 feet. I don't even remember. I have a really bad memory. Because same with Antarctica, like people ask me, what was the temperature there? And I only remember freezing when we were at sea because of the wind effect. And at Antarctica and Everest, I brought for when it got cold, I brought my heavy duty Chicago lakefront running stuff, like Icebreaker. I swear by Icebreaker, that merino wool. So I don't, like with the Everest hike, I only remember like being cold at night again, because there's no heat in the tea houses, and then freezing at base camp overnight. It was more like when the sun was out, you were fine. But at night, when you had to get up and go to the bathroom and try not to break your neck on glacier ice with hiking poles, like that was, yeah.
Oh my God, yeah, I can't even.
I'm so bad. I know people in my group at both races would know what the temperature was, but I don't remember.
So which one is harder, Antarctica or Everest?
Oh, Everest for sure, because the terrain was more technical. For Antarctica, I did it through Marathon Tours, and I did it back in 2008. So I don't know how much more it's changed, but we literally ran where, so there's a bunch of scientific stations there, like the Chilean and the Russian bases were there. And so we literally ran where they drive their four wheelers. So the only part that looked like Antarctica is we had to go up a glacier, and it was a two loop course. And that glacier was a sheet of ice, and someone broke their hip. My friend broke her wrist. But I don't know I think now they require you to wear yak traps. But the terrain at Everest, I mean, I think my marathon at Antarctica was maybe 2 hours slower than my normal. I'd have to check. But Everest, like I said, I'm normally about a 4 hour marathon, and it was 12 hours and 15 minutes racing, not taking pictures.
Wow.
Oh, there was a girl. There was a girl that was there with her dad. They were from Austria. It was her first marathon.
Was she young?
Maybe 20, okay. 20, yeah, early 20s, yeah.
So what would you do? What are you going to do different for now when you go and do the ultra?
I will be trail running for sure. And I won't bring as much stuff as, like, there was a lot of stuff I didn't even need that I brought.
Like what kind of stuff?
I didn't need as many pieces of Icebreaker. And then I have these Columbia pants that are waterproof, and at the knee, they unzip to short. So I would bring two pairs of those instead. And so I train differently. I would definitely do trails and try and find altitude. And then I would pack less, and I would get the waterproof cover for my backpack. And then even in the monsoon, so the porters are carrying our duffel, and that had a laptop in it or a tablet in it. and like battery chargers. So I would have waterproof bags inside my duffel for certain stuff. Plus, when we got to Lukla, all our clothes were wet.
Right.
So in case you're in a monsoon again.
Which makes sense that it would happen again because it's always run May 29th.
So. Yeah. Yeah. And so when we got to base camp, it was just other athletes. There were some other tour companies there. So it was just the other athletes there because almost everyone that had summited was coming down. There was an option with the tour company that you, instead of staying in tea houses, you could have camped the whole way up. Those people, oh my goodness. I like shout out to them. Because we only slept in a tent two nights. They slept in tents the whole way. So they like, yeah, I am in awe. And one of the girls, Vivian, I think she's from San Diego. I think she was the first female to finish the ultra. And she stayed in a tent the whole time. Yeah.
That is insane. How long is the ultra? How many kilometers or miles?
You know, I signed up for it and I think it's 60K. I don't even know. Like, I'm so bad. I did the, this is a funny story. So my girlfriend's, I was telling like, oh, let's go to South Africa and do the Big Five Marathon. You know, we can do all of these, what's it called? Safaris. It'll be so fun. Then we'll go to Cape Town. I didn't realize that's one of the 10 hardest races because, there was a point on the course. Well, some of the course is sand and then it's technical, it's rocks. And there's a point where there's this hill that's got to be over a mile long and it's like 70% grade. I was literally sidestepping it because I felt like if I crawled on my hands and knees, I would have fell backwards. And my friends are like, you are never picking out a race again because I don't do homework.
I'll send you an email. I'll say, okay, it's about time, like 6 weeks out now, you should really get ready to, with a good packing list.
Well, I feel like too that like sometimes when you do so much homework, then you build up these expectations and I'd rather just be more present. And that's the thing about that hike. Right. And why I really loved it is I got all this time to myself.
Right. I mean, yeah, sometimes you do a lot of homework, but I find like when you do your homework, you're like enjoying it both ways, you know, like you enjoy it when you're prepping and then you enjoy it when you're there.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, sometimes you're prepping for things that never happen. It's kind of a waste of your time because it's like, or you pack things that you are not going to need just because you want to be prepared. Yeah.
It's almost like, okay, pretend your birthday's next week. It's like, okay, here's a present. And it's almost like peeking at the present or being surprised, right? I'd rather be surprised. So now whenever I recommend a race, my friends, like they do the due diligence.
you do the recommendation.
Yeah.
So once you are did you do any more sightseeing after Lukla?
Then we flew back to Kathmandu, or no, we flew to a smaller airport and then had a connection. So what happened on the way there is everyone arrived in Kathmandu, and then we took this scary 4-hour bus ride on this windy road. And you wouldn't even think two cars could fit on it, and the huge drop to your, like, down the road, like it was very scary. So we had a four or six hour drive from Kathmandu to the smaller airport, and then that airport to Lukla. So that was the same thing. Once we hiked back to Lukla, we spent the night in Lukla and then flew to the smaller airport, and that's where your bags were weighed. And then we had that crazy drive. So I think that's why some of the people rented a helicopter from Lukla to Kathmandu, because And that's when we all were wishing we did the helicopter, because that was a scary ride. But oh my goodness, I forgot about this. When we were doing the drive the first way on Kathmandu to the small airport, we stopped to use the bathroom and get snacks, whatever. And people put goats on top of their van. They There's nowhere to put it inside the van, and they had goats on the top. I took pictures. I forgot about that.
I was once in a somewhere in the Caribbean. I forgot where. We hopped. I was with friends. This was in another lifetime, but I was with friends. We hopped on this minivan that was going to the other side of the island. I think it was Saint. Gosh, I don't remember. Anyway, we are inside this minivan. Me and my friends, it was like five or six of us. And then everybody else was local. And there was a woman, I will never forget it. She hopped on the van to go to the other side of the island with a chicken. And she sat right there with a chicken. And
say the chicken went, oh my God, say hello to my little friend. Oh my goodness.
And here I am with my friends. I'm like, where's she going with the chicken? Like, is she going to eat the chicken? Like, is she going to sell the chicken? Maybe the chicken is a pet. Yeah, it was really, really funny. And then we stepped out of the van and she stayed. So she was obviously going further, but it was, really funny.
Wild.
With the chicken. It was a good looking chicken. It was big. You know? Yeah. It's one of those things that really shock you from.
Oh, for sure.
Living our country, living civilization, quote unquote. So
everyone arrived in Kathmandu. So we had a couple of days in Kathmandu. And then we did that four or five hour drive to where the smaller airport was. And then that airport to Lukla. And then we hiked. And so for the whole tour, it was a 10-day hike, but we had like 2 days in Kathmandu on the front end and 2 days in the back end. And one, like so many beautiful things. So the last night in Lukla, I forgot, we had our last dinner, and then I think the next day all the porters were going home and the Sherpa, and only our English-speaking guy came with us to Kathmandu. And so that's where we gave him the tips. And somebody like started playing their playlist on their phone, and like the Sherpas start dancing and I'm in there. And then all like some of the people in our group were really reserved. And then they start, I was crying. It was like I was crying just happiness. Like it was one of the most beautiful moments of the trip to like seeing, because when we first got broken into a group of 15 runners or athletes, whatever, you know, we're all like, we don't know each other and we're only talking, and we all bonded. And so what happened was when the song We Are the Champions came on at the goodbye dinner, everybody went crazy. So fast forward, our last night in Kathmandu, they had a really nice dinner for all the athletes. We had like a care package and tips for our English speaking guide, Luang. And I was faking him out. I'm like, hey, we want to do a group picture. Will you come this way? And everyone was already in the room. And so I gave him our gift and a little speech, whatever. And then I'm like, okay, let's do a picture. So everyone went, so I got a picture of everyone, and they all started singing We Are the Champions. So it was so beautiful. Yeah. Oh. So back to how I got there. So on the way there, I flew Chicago to Dubai, Dubai to Kathmandu.
Okay.
And then my friend, Michelle, she did Chicago, Hong Kong, Hong Kong, Kathmandu. And so for me, preview of coming attractions, but on the way home, everybody went home and I flew to Durban, South Africa, to then do Comrades.
Oh, that's awesome. Which we're going to talk in another episode. Yes. So for everybody listening, you guys are going to have to come back, stay tuned in, and listen to Denise again talking about her crazy adventures. I'm sure it's a good one. So
yeah, but I just like, you know, I feel like what this crazy COVID era has taught us is that we don't know if we have today. So if there's something in your heart that is calling you, effing do it.
Right.
Whether it's changing your job or, you know, asking that person out that you're afraid to, or, you know, going to whatever country you've always wanted to see. Yeah. Like, I mean, that was part of the reason I left my career is that, of course, I thought of all the other things that I didn't think I could do, and I did them and I grew from them. And then the impact I was having on strangers through my coaching, like that, connection I was making with strangers. But the third thing was my cousin David. He was 48 years old. This was October 2015, and I quit my job the following June. But he was 48 years old, super healthy, huge hiker. His name was Hiking Dave. He had left his gym and had a heart attack outside the gym. Six kids. Oh. And that was the first time I realized today is not a guarantee. Like, I always knew, and I still know I may not wake up tomorrow, but today is not even a guarantee. And that's why, like, when I talk to my parents on the drive home, I'm like, how many people in their life live out their dreams? And I freaking lived out two, you know? Next time we talk, I'm taking water pills so I don't get emotional. But yeah, I really encourage everyone, like, whatever lightens your heart up like ET, follow it, because today's not a guarantee and we only get one round with this. And right. I'm telling you, like, when you impact strangers, that is so fulfilling.
I agree.
Yeah.
So if people want to connect with you, where should they?
Yes.
Where will they find you?
So you can find me on Instagram, the marathon at Marathon Whisper. And then for coaching, run-for-change.com. But easiest is just look up Marathon Whisper and you'll see me. I forgot to mention, after I left my career, I wrote a book called Me, You, and 26.2, Coach Denise's Guide to Your First Marathon. So you can find that on my website, or you can find it on Amazon, but it's really different. It's not, there's so many training books out there that are, well, mine's different in that it's super inspiring. Like, the cover is a collage of 26 first timers that I've coached. And, there's 26 miles of chapters, and each of those 26 miles starts with one of their stories, like what made them sign up, what would they tell someone who didn't think they could do it. Sprinkled in is all my tips and tricks from 25 years of marathoning. I call them Deniseisms. And then like each of the chapters, aside from the first timer story, there's also like a spectator sign that ties to whatever the chapter's about. So it's, people have read it, reread it like four or five times. And if you think about in your lifetime, how many books you've reread, let alone how many books you've written an author, like, I know it's super inspiring. Yeah.
Yeah. And Denise is going to give away
yes.
to one of the listeners. She's going to give away a book with her signature.
Yeah, I will, for one of the listeners, I will send you, like, whoever wins. Even if you've already run a marathon, there's oodles of tips. But if you know someone in your circle who you know can do a marathon, but they don't think they can, you can send it to them and I'll sign it. Not just my signature. I don't just, like, that's so cold. I write something personal. Yeah. Like, how do I just get a stamp?
Very nice. So this was a complete pleasure. Thank you so much, Denise.
Thank you for inviting me and having me. And I can't wait to see you in real life. It's going to happen.
Oh, I hope I can run Chicago. That's going to be the closest I'm going to get to you, probably.
No, yeah. I travel out, like, once the floodgates open, I normally do like 14 races a year. Yeah. And I travel all over. My goal is to, you know, I'm grateful I found my passion in coaching, but then my other goal is to, like, get as many passport stamps as I can before I die.
Oh, that's a good goal to have. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a great goal.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. So guys, you need to stick around for the next episode in which Denise is going to talk to us about comrades. Bye, Denise.
Bye.
I'll see you in 2 seconds. Sure. Well, guys, I hope you come back to listen to Denise's experience running Comrades Marathon. That's going to be here on the podcast very soon. So just follow us on our other socials so that you keep updated with every single episode that we are recording and uploading. As always, run fearless, you guys.